Well, we'll start with slide 2 here in section 1 on the introduction to software engineering notes. Place you start a lot of courses with definitions. We've got a couple definitions there for software systems and software engineering. Basically, you want to view a software system as a bunch of components, subparts, subsystems, which are all integrating, made up of a bunch of structures and subfunctions that's going to be interacting with each other. Software engineering is a disciplined technology, systematic approach to programming that has arose over the years due to a lot of problems with large system development that have been seen over the decades. We'll be talking about some of those problems. There have been quite a few studies done about programming, research studies. One of the main results that have come out of some of these studies is the one that you're looking at up here. Basically, that if you're developing a large system, there is an inherent cost in fixing the system from time to time when errors and bugs crop up. And it turns out that if you can determine or find the errors during the design phase, it's very easy to fix them. And if you think about that, that's true with any large development process, whether you're doing software development or whether you're constructing something like a bridge. And you can imagine if you're constructing a bridge, and in the design of the bridge you have a flaw, perhaps with the foundation or with the supports. If you don't find that flaw until you've actually made the bridge or you've started to build the bridge, and then you find it while the building is going on or as the building's almost completed, then you can realize, well, what do you have to do? You have to tear it down and rebuild it. And the same thing is true in programming up a large software system. And the relative cost goes up by a factor of about 10 in each of these different phases. Once you move from the design phase, and there's a lot of various levels of design, there's high-level design, low-level design, we'll be talking about that during this semester. Once you move from design to actually coding, once the actual coding process starts and the development process starts, once you find errors in that, it takes about 10 times as much effort to fix those errors. And then once you move on to the actual testing phase, like before, when you start testing the entire system together, then if you find a major error or flaw in the system, you're looking at a cost of about 100 times greater than it would have cost if you had discovered and fixed that error during the design phase. System project managers up at Microsoft, a fellow that they hired away from Digital Equipment Corporation, while he was at DEC, which was bought out by Compaq not too long ago, he oversaw a major operating system development effort at Digital Equipment Corp. And so Microsoft lured him away and got him to basically be the chief technical officer on their development of their NT system, which was the basis for Windows 2000. And he came up with, at that time, something I'd never heard of, which was a bit of a novel approach to development. It was the eat your cake and program on it too method, basically. It was the idea that after the system reached a certain level of development, the developers of software at Microsoft, and you're talking about as many people, if not a lot more people in this room, that would be working on the operating system, all of them working on their own little parts. The operating system, the code's kept in a database. They have to log into the database, check out the code. While they're working on the code, no one else can be working on that part of the code. Then they log the code back in when they're done with it. They fill out their documentation forms about the changes that they've made so that they can track the individual changes that have been made over a period of time. But programmers do this basically at the start of their day and then at the end of their day. They go through this process of checking parts of the code out and checking it back in when they're done, checking other parts out, working on those, checking them back in. Well, after a point when the system became somewhat usable, let's say, they each night from after midnight, they would basically freeze the check-in of the code at that point for a certain number of hours, and then they would recompile all of the code that they had. They would not only recompile the operating system at that point, but once the compilation had finished, they would then go, they would do a network install on all of the developers' machines. And that was the operating system that the developers would then come in the next day and program under. So they had to basically program under the code that they were also using. So they were testing the code while they were doing their development effort. And if you can imagine the type of problems that you could run into in doing that type of development effort, but it was a rather unique effort. Now we can also talk, we've also found out that through the development, through some of the research that's going on, if you look at this table down here at the bottom of this chart, you'll see there's some well-known projects here in terms of the, we're only talking about the software for these projects here. The Apollo Skylab cost about $209 million just for the, that was one of the, that was the first space station that the United States had put up orbiting the Earth, which has since crashed over Australia many years ago. Cost $209 million for the software, contained 23 million instructions in that software, and took about 6,000 man years, person years, whatever, work years to produce. You consider a work year as being a normal job. People work 40 hours a week for 50 hours, 40 hours a week for 50 weeks out of the year. You're talking about 2,000 hours a work of year. So you're 2,000 times 6,000, 18 million hours of work went into that. The NASA satellite range monitoring cost about $30 million, cost about a sixth of the cost of the other one, or a seventh of the cost of the Skylab. Only 1.25 in terms of the million of instructions. Gee, only probably about a 20th of the size in terms of the software, and about 1/6 of the effort. So the cost and the effort on these two seem somewhat related. That seems fair, but the amount of the code doesn't equate at all. Well, it gets worse if you look down here. The FAA air traffic control software, something that when we fly, we sure hope it's bug-proof. Cost about $103 million. These are kind of old studies, so a lot of these software systems have probably been developed since then and redeployed, redeveloped, rewritten from scratch. But the FAA, $103 million, about half the cost of the Skylab software, nowhere near the size of half of it, and took almost the same amount of time. And if you look at the last one down here, the Safeguard ABM, that's the anti-ballistic missile software, that's a piece of software that has never fully been tested. That software has never fully been tested. Why? Why? Because we haven't had a nuclear war, okay? So we'll pray that it will never get tested, okay? But there you can see there it took about half the cost of the Apollo Skylab, nowhere near the same amount of code, same amount of instruction, and roughly about half of the effort. So there's a wide disparity here between these. And we have, you realize in looking at something like this, you might think, well, now is there something wrong? Because shouldn't about the same amount of work cost about the same amount and produce about the same amount? Well, that's somewhat true. And businesses and government agencies and programming companies, computer companies over the years have realized these differences. They accept some of them. Certainly some software, like for example, the air traffic control software, that software probably has to have a much higher degree of reliability than maybe Microsoft Word, for example, okay? If Microsoft Word crashes, well, okay, you restart it and pick up from where you left off, okay? If the air traffic control software crashes, it might not be the only thing that crashes. And there are a lot of well-known examples throughout the computer industry, unfortunately, of fatalities that have resulted because of buggy software. When you take the computer science 3604 course, you're going to study some of those where people have died, unfortunately, because of buggy software. So there's not only a desire because of control the cost and time of development, but there's also this desire to control the quality of software development. And that's part of what software engineering is trying to get at. In terms of the cost, you can look at this graph up at the top tier. There's a cost in terms of the total cost of the system. There's a number of modules. Think of a module as a function, the number of total functions in a system. Well, the cost per component or per module, obviously as the number of modules goes up, that's going to get reduced quite a bit. And as the interfacing and integration cost over here on the right, that will go up, of course. With the larger the number of functions in the system, the harder it's going to be to make sure that they all communicate correctly and work together correctly. There is a happy medium in the middle to where you kind of optimize the number of functions and the interfacing and integration costs, and that'll control your overall cost of the system. What that is, I can't give you a formula. I can't give you a formula that says for a system that has X number of pure lines of C++ code, you plug in this formula and f of X gives you the optimal number of functions for that system. No such formula exists. It's too dependent upon the problem that you're working on. You basically will arrive at a feel for hitting the optimal point in here through experience, and part of what you're going to be gaining in this class. So, up until this point, you've probably been thinking about programming as coding and the idea of writing code being the entire purpose of programming. Well, now we want you to get into a little bit different thinking mode here. In terms of software design, think of it as a set of goals where you're selecting components and piecing them together by stating their functions and their interface and integrating everything together to get it to work correctly. And you can take all this down for those of you who are writing, but you will be getting copies of all of these once the notes are available. And these things are, most of this is actually up on the website at the moment. So, one of the things that has come about over the years is a lot of times we have some developer here who's developing some software, and in their mind, they have an idea of how things fit together, how they work together, how they decompose the system up. Basically, they have the design of the system up here in their mind. And a lot of times, unfortunately, somebody else, some other poor slob like Wally down here, gets hired to maintain and modify this code, and he basically has to become a mind reader at that point. If all he's got is the code to look at, he's got to become a bit of a mind reader, even if the code is fairly well documented. The code itself doesn't really give you the overall structure, the overall design and integration and decomposition of the system. And I've unfortunately got in this role, which might explain my loss of hair from time to time. I've been hired by companies who have asked me to modify programs before, and I usually take a look at the program, all of their documentation with it, and unfortunately, far too often, I have to go back to them and tell them, okay, you can pay me to modify this, or you can pay me to just rewrite the system from scratch. And I can tell you that if you pay me to rewrite the system from scratch, you'll be paying me less in the long run, because I have no idea how to read the mind of this fruit who put together this program. Okay? And the problem was that they just didn't. The person was probably a decent programmer, but they let them get away with not documenting their design of the system. If they will actually create a design document basically something that's concrete, specific. We can analyze it. We can compare it to the implementation. We can use it to trace through the life cycle. That makes it a lot easier for someone else coming along who needs to modify the system. And basically, here's what a design should contain: components, procedures, functions. Each of the functions should have a suggested name. That'll give us the function of it. The interfaces, it needs to specify not only the data interfaces. When you think of functions calling other functions, the interface is the parameter communication that's going on. But there are really two types of parameter communication between functions. There's strict data communication, where they're just passing data back and forth. But there's also a certain set of their parameters that is classified as control parameters. If you're passing some data from one function to another, or parameters from one function to another, and yet you're using these parameters to control the execution of code, those parameters are a lot more important, in a sense, because they affect the execution of the system, than just the data parameters that don't affect the execution. And so we refer to these parameters as control parameters. Ideally, we would like to minimize the number of control parameters in a system. The perfect system would be one that has no control parameters being passed around, so that there's no execution information being passed around from one function to another. But that goal is very difficult to achieve, and so we try to minimize it as much as possible. There's some offshoots of that that come about that makes the systems a lot better to work with if we can do it. In here, and you're going to learn several design methodologies probably before you get out of here, a few. We're going to use one called structure charts in here. Now, structure charts are just a way of representing the design of a system. There's nothing very complex about them. They don't have a formal syntax that gets specified in some book. Okay? There are design methodologies like that, and you might learn one of them, like UML, the Unified Modeling Language, before you get out of here. But programming languages, as far as I'm concerned, are tough enough to keep up with all of the syntax, semantics, and all of the documentation and requirements that you have to. I don't really want that type of level of detail in my design tool that I'm using. And there isn't that in structure charts. I'm going to give you, there is no really one set design document for structure charts that I can point you to that says this is the Bible of how structure charts are created. Okay? I'm going to give you what I've pulled together from a bunch of different authors, a bunch of different textbooks, and a bunch of different design document specifications that says this is sort of the most common usage of structure charts. So the basic structure chart is just a graphical representation of a design of a system, not a flow chart. A lot of you may have learned a flow chart. A flow chart is sort of low-level design. Flow charts equate very, very closely to code. Okay, structure charts do somewhat, but it's at a higher level of design. In structure charts, the only thing you're really focused upon at the code level is individual functions. Within the functions or the individual statement level, you don't concern yourself with that much. For structure charts, basically, they represent all of those features a good design document should that we just went over. The idea is that we basically just draw up a rectangle for each function that we're going to create, code up, or use in our system. We put on our structure chart, a rectangle, and we label it with the name of the function, a good name of the function that tells us what the function is doing. A function should only really be performing one action. You should be able to write one simple sentence that tells what a function is doing. If you have to write a compound sentence to tell what the function is doing, it's doing more than one thing, and you probably should be breaking it up at that point. So, we also represent an execution call from one function to another by using an arrow. We just connect the two rectangles that represent the function. This indicates that this function getWord contains a call in it to get next character. Nothing complex about that. Now, in order to represent the parameter float, basically the interface of the system, to represent the interfaces, we have to represent the three types of direction flow of information between functions and the two different classes of parameters that flow between the functions. The three types of directions. If we have one-way communication, where the communication is only from the calling function to the called function, then it is a value parameter. It's a value parameter, it's being passed by value, and it's termed an input parameter. So for this example up here, this would be an input parameter. We basically draw a little circle up with a little arrow, and we indicate that this is going to be flowing in this direction, and we also put the name of the parameter right here by this little arrow. And that indicates that it is flowing in that one direction only, and that it is an input parameter. So when you decide that as you're designing your function, and you decide that this call function needs just a copy of that value to carry out its task, but it doesn't need to change that parameter, then you make it an input parameter, and you pass it by value. We can also have output parameters. If you have if you need to send back a computed value or an input value from this called function, then and it doesn't matter what, if it had a value coming in or not. In other words, you're going to be assigning this parameter some new value, even if it had an old value, it won't matter because you'll be destroying it. In that case, it's an output parameter. And in some cases, you will need what's called an input-output parameter, where you'll need a value for a parameter coming in, and you're going to change that parameter and send the change back, but the change will be based upon the incoming value of the parameter. In that case, it needs a value coming in, and it gets a new value going out. And so it is both an input and output parameter in that instance. So that's the three types of direction flow.
For the input output, if you had a function that would only, like, say, change your data sometimes, would you still classify that as input output, or do you define it based on instance?
So you're saying that, in some of the calls it would change it and some it would not.
Yes.
If it changes it at least once, then you consider it to be changing it all the time. Okay? In terms of indicating the possible change on the structure chart. Now, those are the three types of direction flow. The two types of classifications of parameters is just what I mentioned to you before. We either have data parameters or control parameters. It's a control parameter if it is controlling the execution of code, which means if the parameter appears in a condition of an if statement, if it appears in the condition of a loop statement like a for or a while, or if it appears like in a switch in the condition for a switch statement, if it's used to somehow control execution, then it's a control data. The way you indicate whether something is a control or data parameter, if it's a control parameter, you darken in the little circle. Okay, it's attached to the arrow. That indicates that this is a control parameter. And if it's not being used for control, then it is left open here to indicate that it's a data parameter. Now, let's see here. Yeah, here's an example. We've got this void get next character up there. We've got get character down here. And we've got some call here, as you can see, from get next character, we're calling get character. We're passing it CH, up low, and terminator. You'll notice that on the label of the structure chart, the actual parameter names are used on the labels for the structure chart, not the formal parameter names. The actual parameter names are the ones that are actually being passed. Okay? The ones that are listed in the call of the function from the calling function. Not the ones that are listed in the heading of the called function. Those are the formal parameters. So we label those with the actual parameter names. And we can see here if we look at the first one, CH is being matched up here to car, act, or whatever. It's being passed by reference. And if you think about it, get character is probably reading in some character from the keyboard, sending it back. So it doesn't matter if it had a value coming in or not. So therefore, CH is going to just be an output data parameter. The upload type here for the uppercase or lowercase, however, it's probably to be converted. That's being passed by value, so that's only an input data parameter. And the last one here, terminal. This is a reference parameter, and it's being used to indicate whether it's a terminating character, like an end of line character or end of file character. And there's an if statement immediately in the calling function right after the call to get character. And it says if terminated. So it's being used to control execution. So in this case, and we're assuming here that the resetting of terminal doesn't depend upon any input value coming in, of it having a value coming in. It's an output control parameter. So it's darkened in with the direction going out. That's pretty much it. Function return values, when a function is returning a value rather than the function type being void here, those are treated as output parameters, and you list the variables in the calling function to which they're assigned. Calls to multiple functions. When you have one function calling multiple functions, they're usually listed left to right in terms of their order of call. That's not a hard and fast structure chart rule, but it's the convention that most people adopt when they're actually laying out the design of their system. Questions? Any time while I'm going over this, you've got questions, ask me now.
I understand the importance of documentation and so that you can define interfaces holding you code, but I don't understand the problem if you have code without documentation because you couldn't just simply write a program to parse the code and come up with documentation code.
Actually, you can. There are what's called CASE tools, computer-aided software engineering tools. These things used to cost thousands and thousands of dollars, which the better tools would basically allow you to feed in a bunch of code, and it would draw you up a structure chart for that code. But the better tools, and this is actually not the way it's done, the first thing that most people do when they're developing a large system is those CASE software tools actually are like drawing packages. And they help you basically draw up your structure chart. And once you've got your structure chart for the entire system drawn up, then you can tell it to generate code. Now that doesn't mean it's going to generate your system for you. It'll generate code that'll match. It'll generate function headings for you. It'll put calls from one function into another function. It'll list the parameters down there for you. It basically does sort of an outline, putting in as much code as it can according to the specifications of the structure chart. But for a very large system, there's just no way that you can just jump into a system that's going to be composed of millions of lines of code and hope to hold it all in your mind. You can't do it. I don't know if anybody can do it. There have been a lot of famous studies done. One of the ones done back in the 20s or 30s explains why telephone numbers are 7 digits long. Why are telephone numbers 7 digits long.
That's
the average amount of what's called short-term memory that the human mind can remember, okay, without straining their poor little gray cells, okay? If you're a more intelligent person, you might be able to hold 2 or 3 times that much in your short-term memory. But eventually, and I don't care who you are, your short-term memory will blow up. And your short-term, you know, if the average is about 7 things, then who in their right mind is going to try and design a system that has millions of lines of code and try and hold it all in short-term memory?
I understand what you're saying there, but I don't understand. You said at the beginning of the problem.
It really doesn't matter at some point whether you understand this or not, because this is the way it's done, and this is the way it will be done.
I understand, and I use documentation like this myself. I'm talking about, you gave the problem at the beginning where you were given a system with no documentation.
That's right.
And my question is, why couldn't you just write code to parse that information into...
Oh, I could. Of course, they'd have to pay me to write that program. Or they could go out and buy some case software a lot of times for the companies that don't have it. But they're usually looking and spending around $1,000 just to buy the software. For a lot of times, for a lot of companies, that's cheap, and some of them will do that. But even so, those tools are only so good. And they can't, it's like if you've used disassemblers. They can't really come up with everything that you need to know to correctly reflect what that person was thinking about when they did the design to begin with. Their systems are only so good and they're limited. Questions? That's to indicate that it's a control parameter. Because it's being used in the if statement following the call in the calling function. Okay? All of the others we're assuming there are not going to be used in if statements or while statements, and therefore they are just data parameters. And that's why their little circles are not filled in.
Okay.
That's right, and they probably will. Most of the time, when you do initial design of a system, you will not be able to think through everything. Okay, that will happen. However, the initial design of a system, as opposed to the final design, should not differ by more than probably 25%. If it differs by more than 25%, then you didn't do a good enough job up front with the initial design. You were too friggin' lazy. Okay? And in here, later on, for the programs you're going to submit in here, you will be drawing up structure charts. You will be submitting initial structure chart design. Then you will go through the coding process, and you'll submit your final structure chart design. And I expect, and we will have the GTAs do a quick comparison between the two. And I expect to see changes between the initial design and the final design. That's common. But I don't expect to see any more than about 25% changes. If I do, then you're going to lose points, because basically you didn't do enough work up front. Okay? Let's finish. There's a few other things here. To represent conditional calls that may or may not actually execute. You can see here in this function move, we've got a call to drawBox that's being controlled by this if statement. So depending on whether that if statement is true or not, that call may or may not actually execute. Well, we indicate that on a structure chart by the little diamond box here, okay, that shows we use basically the same sort of symbol that flowcharts use, the diamond to represent a decision. And we just indicate the call from that, and we also label up here above the little diamond, you usually put the, it's common to put the variable the main variable that's being used to make that decision, to being used to determine whether or not that function is called or not. Okay? That's the way we indicate conditional calls. If you have a switch statement, and you have multiple calls to other functions, then they all emanate. You just have multiple calls emanating from that same diamond. As you can see here, basically like an if-else statement. We've got multiple calls emanating from that one. For loops, where we have a function that might be called a given number of times from another function. Well, we indicate that, we use a little decision loop here. We still use the little black and then circle diamond, and then we draw a little loop. We also, the main loop control variable is used to label the diamond, and then in all of the functions that are in that loop that might be called, their arrows will emanate from within that little loop. Nothing complex about that. Hello. Wake up. Recursive functions. Routines that call themselves, we indicate with a little extra left-hand side flange, okay, on the rectangle. Calls to operating system functions are indicated like this with a half open circle or so, or a three quarters open circle. Don't complete the circle. It means something a little bit different. Predefined modules. If we're using functions from library routines, we usually indicate those by using double vertical lines on the rectangle chart. Now, the level of detail, you can go into a very detailed level with structure charts. I'm probably not going to have you indicate these two, the operating system calls and the predefined standard, certainly not for the predefined standard library calls to when you're calling like input-output stream functions like getLine or something, or when you're calling stream class functions. I'm not going to have you indicate those on the structure chart. We could, but we're not going to. Now, what will happen quite often, your structure charts will get to be fairly large and they'll span many pages. And so what you'll do, when you've got one function that's being called from a lot of places down in your code, rather than drawing a whole bunch of lines to really mess up your drawing, you'll use a little connector symbol. Usually it's just an abbreviation of the capital letters of the function, and you'll indicate calls going to a little circle abbreviated like that, and then at some point you'll indicate the calls to the actual function. Those are just used for multiple spanning pages connecting. Okay? Now, quite often what will also happen is that sometimes you'll have a large number of parameters between two functions. So large of a number that they won't easily fit on a structure chart. And so what you can do is rather than, now here we've got them labeled in both places. There's X, Y, Z being shown as input data parameters and the polar coordinates. What you'll do is you can draw up a little circle unconnected with a little number in it. And then elsewhere on another sheet of paper, you'll label your interface diagram. And that interface diagram will basically just be a table which will show the input output parameters for that function call. You'll list down the parameter names. You'll list down whether it's a data or a control parameter. You'll list down whether it's an input output or input output, whether it's both, and a brief description. That's another way of, that's an optional way of representing the parameters rather than showing them directly on the chart. However, it's better most of the time if you've got if you only have a small number of parameters, if you've only got 6 or 8 parameters, it'd be better just to show them right on the chart so that someone doesn't have to look at your chart and go flipping through other pages to find the parameters.
Yeah, I have a question, kind of related to the, like the really large design stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Do they like if they have like some really really huge thing, like they have like a once, and then like two different levels of complexity, like one really, really huge, and then like start inside of different huge blocks, like going in more detail to have it.
You can do that, yes, and I'll show you a sort of pseudo example of that here in a moment. Okay. Yes, you can. You can do finer grain drawings, but usually the drawing programs have tools in them to help you do that nowadays. Global data. You can represent global data by using what's called a global cost reference chart, but since we're not going to be using global data in here, unless you wish to have the GTA pull out their paint, red paintbrush and bleed all over your program, we won't go over that one. Let me show you some examples of structure charts, and there's actually some examples up on the website. If you go over here to the program section, like my new submit button, okay. Really nice, huh? Whatever. If you go to some of these, here you'll see the structure chart for this one, the BAM project that was done in the spring of 99, and up here in the spring of 99 is the specifications for that system. If we look at that structure chart, okay, here it is basically. Fun, huh? Yeah. So there are some examples online. I'm going to throw you up a few right now. You can see some examples of this online. You can do your drawing of these things in whatever drawing package you wish to use. I'll put you, Microsoft Word is not that bad to do it in, believe it or not, using Draw, using the Draw package that's built into it. I was thinking up here somewhere. I thought I had a link here. Whatever. Bummer. There's only 8.5, 11 standards out of page out from Word, blah, blah, so we can print them out if we need to. Basically, your structure charts need to be what's called a vector graphic drawing, not a bitmap. So don't use a paint program, okay? If you don't know the difference, you'll be learning it in 1205 for those of you who are taking, 1204 for those of you who are taking CS 1204. A vector-based drawing is one that represents, it's used for sort of technical drawings. It represents geometric figures inside the document by using their mathematical equation representation, which is a lot more efficient than representing. You can represent a circle basically by just its, where its center point is at on the document and the radius. That gives the program enough information to draw the circle. In a bitmap program, in order to represent the circle, it stores the point of each of the pixels that's on the outer circumference of the circle. And bitmap programs are usually used for image processing programs. Drawing programs are usually vector-based. Word drawing tools, not the photo editor inside of it, but its drawing tools are vector-based. I'll put up a couple links at some point to a couple free pieces of software. They're not the greatest, but then they are free. Okay. If you want to buy one, you can. There are some expensive ones. Microsoft Visio, but it's fairly not cheap. Smart Draw is one that's a shareware program, but it's still not cheap too. And there are a few others. I think there's one called Top Down and a couple others. There's some out there that's designed almost for drawing up design documents in a structure chart or pseudo structure chart like manner. And you're more than welcome to buy those, but you're not required to. The stuff that's in the drawing features that's inside of Word will certainly suffice for what we're going to do in here. And I will require you to submit your structure chart design in a Word document. Okay? Not in a bitmap in a Word document, but in a vector-based drawing in a Word document. So here are some more examples. If you want to look at some examples of structure charts. Here's one. This guy used a 3D perspective drawing for this one. Okay. This was for a what was this one? Draw me a dog deal. Yeah, this was our database. Yeah, this is the database OpScan grading program, where when you submit OpScans, the OpScans, of course, get converted to files, which then get graded. Well, we wrote our own system to do that in here one semester, using the grading files that were generated over at the testing center here at Tech. You'll notice that he doesn't have any of his parameters on here. He's got them labeled for his basically his interface diagrams here. Okay, he's got them all labeled here from one function to another function. He's got them all labeled whether they're data parameters or control parameters, input, output parameters, the description of them. We'll ignore that one. Oh, here's a good one. Here's one we did for a little budget planner for a house, a budget planner for a house. Here's the other part of it. Here's the right part of it, whatever. Brian, he's up at Microsoft right now. Sharp student. Ah, Phillip's in the PhD program now. This one we did, this project, well, this was done about 10 years ago. This was an HTL Hypertext Limited system. We did this back around 91 before the web actually got started. Hypertext systems existed. And we actually wrote one in this class. Hypertext system, very limited compared to the web nowadays, but it was a hypertext system where basically we did a browser in a sense, where someone could read a document and that document would contain links and they could click on a word and it would link to another document. And we basically did that in this class at one point. You'll notice he's got quite a few here that are round, okay? These are to the connectors for these others. He's got handle command down here. This was his main function. Here's handle command. Open new book. Define window. Okay, Phil must not have had a life that semester. Goodness gracious. We got to get that boy a life sometime. Okay. Gosh, this just keeps going on and on and on. Jeez. I'd have a talk with that kid. Goodness, look at all this. That kid's got some serious emotional issues we've got to discuss. Just a joke. Phil's in our PhD program now. He's just about ready to get out of here. Here's one. We actually wrote a program for other programmers. It was basically a menu managing system. sort of like a pseudo interface system where, but we just did the menus, where someone would use our system to tell us what the names of their menus were, how many they wanted, and then what options were going to be on each of the menus, what should be on the taskbar, and what function would be called when each of these menus were displayed. And then we had some other code that they could embed to actually do the function calling and everything else in their program. But this one was pretty much the drawing portion of the system. It continues here. No, I guess it keeps going here. I think I actually drew this one up. Wow. That one's going, okay, I think that goes down, yeah, that goes down to here. This one, okay. Looks like that's about the end of it, thank goodness. You were talking about fine grain, well, okay. That is the overall structure of that system. Not the greatest morphology for the system. The overall shape of a design, ideally, what you would really like for a well-designed system, you won't achieve this very often, but for a well-designed system, you start off, you know, you have main at the top or whatever, and then you show your decomposition. Your first sort of decomposition of your system. And then each of those you decompose further and further. And so you have a high fan out that keeps increasing as you go down through the system. But then you start using a lot of functions from multiple other functions. And so that high fan out starts to sort of coalesce. Now it won't coalesce perfectly, but it'll at least coalesce some. And that's the ideal shape, what most people consider to be the ideal design of a system. And you can see a little bit of that here, but not a lot. And you're not required on the structure chart to do this, but I went ahead and drew up just for the heck of it. Here's the data structure that we were using. Basically, here's each of the menus, and each of those menus hanging off of that double-linked list was another double-linked list of options that would basically get created as the user would tell us what options they wanted. So that's what you're going to be doing this semester, part of what you're going to be doing.
Yep.
And that's fine. That's a fine way to draw it up the way Phil had it there. You will notice though that for his main one, let me see if I can find it in all of this mess again. Here it is, I think, yeah. For his main one, he did manage to fit on the structure chart. He did manage to fit on all of the calls. And a lot of those, though, he did indicate were not shown right here, that they're shown on another slide, basically, or on another drawing. The ones that are a circle are the connectors. Rather than using, like, DW for define window as the name for his connector, he just used the name of the function as his connector. And that's fine. He just drew it up as a circle to indicate that he's not showing you the actual function there. Okay? So he did manage to fit most of it. The way I did it on this one that I drew, I sort of took the cheap way out of doing that, and I just used, I basically just did that to sort of show the overall structure. I basically just shrunk the thing down. Even though you can't get a whole lot of meaning from this, you can at least see the overall structure of the system. So you can do that a lot of times too. You can get a little bit creative with structured charts. There is no set syntax. I want you to follow these guidelines that I've put up here for the most part, fairly closely. But you won't lose points because you don't have the exact syntax. Other questions? Well, by your fourth program, which will be based upon the other three that you do, you'll have a drawing that looks something like this, probably, at least in terms of its amount of complexity. But you'll be doing that throughout the semester. You'll basically do your drawings. I may not actually have you do an initial structure chart for the first one. I haven't decided. I have sometimes in the past, sometimes I haven't. I want to think about that a little bit more. You will be doing structure charts for the last three. And when you finish a structure chart for one program and submit it, when you get ready to start on the next program, you'll just take that structure chart, copy it, and start building off of it. Okay? So you'll build up to something like this. Other questions? No, not for, especially not for any of the standard system header functions that you're going to be calling, that's in the standard includes. No, you don't need to put those up. No string functions, need to be indicated. That predefined library indicator is usually used if you're using a non-standard library along with your program. And we're not going to be doing that in here. Like if, in the past, as I told you last time, we have in this class previously used the graphical user interface library. Well, I did have the students indicate when they used that library what functions of the library they were using. But we're not going to be doing that in here. Other questions?
You said that we were going to draw all of our drawings in Word.
Well, you don't have to draw them. You can draw them in Word. But you can also use another drawing program and then import them into a Word document when you do your submit. You can get them in there a couple ways. You can try from your drawing program to just, for example, select the drawing or the part that you're wanting to take into Word, copy it to the clipboard, and go into Word and paste it. That may or may not work, or may not work as well as you would like it to, depending upon the support for the clipboard that the other program has. What you can do a lot of times, though, in some of these other drawing programs, they will have a save as off of their function, and they'll have a file type. And they'll allow you to save it as different file types. Now, you've got to be a little bit careful, because some of those programs will let you save it as a bitmap file type and as a structure vector graphic file type. Bitmap file types are stuff like BMPs, bitmaps, JPEGs, GIFs, TIFFs, and a few others that I can't think of at the moment. But there are some standard vector basic file formats like Windows Metal File, WMF. The CorelDRAW, CDR, CDW, some of those are vector-based. And so you can, from your drawing program that you're using, you can maybe save it. If the import through the clipboard doesn't work, you just save it as a Windows Meta file, and then you go into Word and you go up to, I forget which menu, but there's an insert picture, okay, and you can choose that, and if Word will import that file type, it'll show it to you in the open dialog box at that point. Other questions? And you may have to play with that some from one program to another to see how well that works. Word has all of these different symbols that I've just shown you that you need for a structure chart. It's got them up there for you. You can piece them together. And what you can do in Word is you can make a little document in Word. I think I have one which I'll try and post up. But one thing that you can do, now wait a minute, I've got 435, right? What do you guys have? 435? Yeah, this class doesn't really end until 445. You don't know me very well, do you? Is there something going on at 5 that I don't know about? Is there some party I haven't been invited to, which happens a lot? What you can do in Word is you can basically, in one document, you can kind of draw these things up. You can just draw you like a rectangle. You can draw you up a little connector with an arrow, a little connector with a filled-in dot and an arrow. Basically draw you up these things and then just copy them from one and paste them in as you need them and reposition them so you don't have to be drawing them new each time. Sort of build you up sort of like a little template thing that you can cut and paste when you need it. Okay? Yes? Do I want an overall shrunken down version? No. No, that's not required. It's nice, but it's not required. Okay? All right. I am a nice guy. You can go.